This is Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Our first guest today is Ryan Zenk, Managing Director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, based in Brookfield. He's an attorney and a certified financial planner. And Ryan is also the CEO of Family Wealth Advisors, LLC, and co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. What questions do you have about writing a will or setting up a trust or maybe covering the cost of nursing home care? Join the conversation. Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email. It's talk@wpr.org. Ryan, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jill. Glad to be here.
So it sounds like you cover pretty much everything.
Well, definitely not everything. It's I like to tell people I know a lot about a little.
Oh, yeah. Well, me too, right? Right. I say I'm a Jill of all trades, right? So, right. so tell us a little bit more, actually, about what all your businesses cover.
Okay. Well, our firm, Estate Planning Elder Law Center, is largely involved with two areas: estate planning, which is wills, trusts, and other tools that people use to pass their estate on to their intended beneficiaries. And then the other area of our practice, which is probably over 50% of our practice, deals with families that are either planning against a potential crisis like a long-term care event, or in many cases they are already in one or experiencing one, and they want to understand what their rights are, what their opportunities are to protect assets. So, for example, a non-disabled spouse doesn't have to become impoverished because their spouse is has a long-term care situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly can be so difficult. It's really nice to have a guide along the way. Another thing that's difficult is, you know, for families to talk about the, you know, loved one's money and property and how it should be handled after they die. How do you deal with that when families come to you?
Well, you're correct. That is a difficult thing to approach, and more so for some families, I'm sure, than others. But, you know, I tell people death is a certainty. You know, we,
yes,
we all get one death per person per lifetime. And so it does make sense to plan for it. And it's not something you have to continually dwell on. It's something that you should get a plan in place for, and then put it aside and go about and live your life and enjoy your life. Every once in a while, you may need to take it off the shelf, dust it off, go in and see a professional and just make sure things are up to date. And so, you know, if you don't plan for it, typically there's going to be more work and more cost for those who come after. An analogy I use, I said, you know, you don't have to change the oil in your car. You can drive your car for a while without changing the oil, but eventually it's going to cost you more because you didn't change the oil.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so it makes sense to plan for something that is 100% inevitable, and it's often far less expensive. Often by not planning for it, what you're doing is you may be making the legal community, the courts, attorneys, a partial beneficiary of your estate when you could have passed it on to your loved ones.
Well, that makes a whole lot of sense looking at it that way. Is there a certain, I mean, financially, does it make more sense that the more assets you have, the more details that you need and the more help you need? Is that pretty much the way it works?
That can be the case, but it is not strictly based on the size of the estate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we meet a lot with families where they'll have particular concerns. They may have a disabled child that they want to provide for, and it doesn't matter if it's $1 million or $10,000. That's a goal of theirs. Or they may have a charity that they're very concerned, and they want to make sure that the assets, you know, go to that particular cause that they very much support. And often there's really simple things that they can do. So it's not necessarily just the dollar amount at all.
Okay. So what is the first step in getting your legal and medical affairs in order?
Well, I'm not trying to be self-serving, but what really makes sense is probably to contact a professional and have an initial consultation. And a lot of estate planning attorneys in Wisconsin don't charge for an initial consultation. They'll sit down and have a discussion. They may charge, some may charge, and some may not, but it makes sense to do that. It's well worth a person's time to do that.
Okay, well, let's take the medical power of attorney first. Why don't you explain first what that does?
Sure. So a medical power of attorney, like any power of attorney, is where someone gives someone else the authority to do something, to make decisions for them. In the case of a medical power of attorney, it's the ability to make medical decisions for them. And I do want to give a little brief disclaimer that as I'm having a conversation here today with folks in that, this isn't intended to be considered legal advice. I do expect everyone to seek appropriate counsel for their own situation, but I'm going to talk generally here. And as far as the medical power of attorney is concerned, this allows someone that you trust to make healthcare decisions for you in the event that you are unable to make those decisions yourself. So under Wisconsin law, the agent's authority, so the person that you name as your agent to make medical decisions for you, their authority kicks in only upon incapacity, okay? Mm-hmm. And how is incapacity defined? It's defined in the state of Wisconsin by two physicians, or a physician and one licensed advanced practice clinician. So basically, if you cannot make your own medical decisions and two physicians sign a statement that you're unable, that you don't have the capacity to do that, then your agent's authority kicks in and they can make decisions for you. So it's very important that people have a medical power of attorney. And in Wisconsin, people don't even need to see an attorney to get one. You can go to your local hospital, medical care provider. You can go online and look for the Wisconsin statutory medical power of attorney, complete it, have a couple witnesses sign off, and you have it in place. And one thing a lot of people, I think, miss is like when their children become adults and turn 18, that child should get a, now I understand they're not a child anymore, they're still your child though. Mm-hmm. They should get a medical power of attorney, because the parents no longer automatically have the right to make a decision for them. They're no longer their legal guardian. So it's important for everyone, really, that is an adult, to have a medical power of attorney.
Yeah, that makes wonderful sense. Now, what would happen if, you know, you've got a 20-year-old at college, something happens, and a medical decision needs to be made? Who then can make that decision?
You could be in a guardianship situation then.
Oh, okay.
So now you're talking court costs, you're talking delays, you know, you're talking significant attorney's fees and that can all be avoided really for free,
right?
Filling it out.
So once you
or seeing an attorney have it done.
Once you get that form filled out, then what do we do with it?
Good question. We recommend that people give a copy to their agent, the person who you're naming.
Mm-hmm.
Give a copy to your primary care physician, and give a copy to the hospital that you're most likely to be taken to at 3 a.m. if there's an emergency. And then let your agent know where you're keeping the original so they can access it if necessary.
Okay. So do you recommend keeping papers like that in an off-site place in case, you know, something happened to your home?
It's not necessarily a bad idea, although it's relatively, you know, inconvenient, and I understand that. We mm-hmm. appreciate that. So, you know, you can buy those little fireproof safes online at, you know, I'm mentioning a particular retailer, but you can go to the store or buy those, and that might be an option. Some people still have safety deposit boxes. The issue with having it stored off-site, again, is you want your agent to be able to access that if you are storing it off-site, to know where it is and be able to get at it, because they may need to access the original.
And in this digital age, is it okay to put it up on the cloud somewhere?
It's probably not. It won't hurt to put it up on a cloud, but again, I would have an original available and accessible.
Okay. All right. Let's go to a caller. Sheila in La Crosse, go right ahead.
Yes, hello. I'm living in my house and intend to do that for a long time, but I'd like the equity of my house to go to my disabled daughter. And I don't know how to do that because I really don't have anyone to serve as my agent. It's just my daughter and I. And so I was wondering about what I do when I don't have anyone. And then secondly, how to set up a disability trust.
Okay. Go ahead, Ryan.
Sure. Well, you have a number of, the good news is you have a number of options. So, As you, I think, understand, a possibility is to have a trust that you either create right now and then fund. You put the house in it. Funding is a lawyer word for putting the house in the trust, for example. You either put it in there now or you put it in later, but that would require you to name a trustee. There are corporate trustees out there. There's quite a number of them in Wisconsin. Another option that you have in Wisconsin, Wisconsin has a public pooled trust called WISPAC, and they will act as a trustee, and you can contact an attorney and have a discussion with them about a WISPAC trust. There are monies available to help cover the cost. There may be monies to cover the cost of setting that up as well. So that may be a very, very logical option for you. And so you can either set the trust up yourself or you can use the pooled trust. And if you set the trust up, there's different ways to do that. You can have something as simple as a will where the trust is created under the will. The downside of that is it does require it to go through probate to get the trust set up. Another option is to do a standalone special needs trust that's created now, that's funded either at this time or at the time of your death. So you do have a number of options. I would recommend that you have a consultation with an attorney who specializes in that area, and you can, if you know of one or can get a recommendation, or you can contact the Wisconsin State Bar and ask for a recommendation for attorney in your area. But you do have quite a number of options to do that. And there are some significant exceptions in the law with abilities to pass assets to a disabled individual. There's exceptions under Medicaid planning where, if it's done properly, assets can be transferred for the benefit of a disabled individual, and those assets won't affect your eligibility for Medicaid like they normally would if you try to gift assets away to try to protect them. So,
okay, Sheila, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you, and good luck with that. Our guest today is Ryan Zenk. He's the Managing Director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, based in Brookfield. He's also an attorney and a certified financial planner. And he's here to talk about estate planning and end-of-life medical directives. What questions do you have for him? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Coming up at 12:30, we're going to talk to the director of the Oconomowoc Area Historical Society and Museum about the city's connection to the classic film, The Wizard of Oz. That's at 12:30 right here on The Larry Mueller Show. But right now, we're helping you with your estate planning. With questions, please give us a call. The lines are open, 800-642-1234. Ryan, we've had a couple of emails. First, Susan in Manitowoc emailed that their daughter is urging them to put her house in a trust. Suzanne says she does not live in it, that it's an investment property, and the plan is that it goes to Susan's son. She said if she sells it, he will pay heavy capital gains. Now, Suzanne wants to keep the house until her death in case she needs it for what it's worth to pay for her care, and Suzanne says she has no other assets that could be placed in a trust.
Okay, so if her intention is to use that asset if she needs care in the future, that makes a lot of sense. She has a number of options. Wisconsin has a number of different opportunities to pass assets down to intended beneficiaries without the cost and delay associated with the probate system, and I can, outline that. But there are some very, very simple ways. One way in Wisconsin that folks use that's very simple is simply to list beneficiaries on your real estate. It's called a transfer on death deed. And I'm not saying that this is the right thing for anyone in particular. There are certainly other options. But if you use a transfer on death deed, it's similar to putting a beneficiary on an account. You're simply saying, if I still own this particular property when I die, this is who I want it to go to, and I don't want to have to set up a trust now. I don't want it to have to go through probate. I just want it to be relatively simple.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's done, and there's a lot of other ways to do it, too, to be clear, but the beneficiary will receive what's called a step-up in basis, under current law anyway, so that when that son, in this case, inherits the property, he can turn around and sell it, and he will not have to pay any capital gains on any of the appreciation that happened during mom's lifetime. Okay, so mm-hmm. He gets what's called a step-up in basis on the property.
Okay. So basically that means that when Suzanne bought the property, that's the amount it was worth when he sells it?
So let's say mom buys a house for $100,000.
Uh-huh.
And if it's an investment property, mom probably takes some deductions, some depreciation on it. And so that reduces her basis in it. I don't want to get too technical here, but mm-hmm. And let's say the property is worth $200,000 when mom passes away. If mom sells it during her lifetime, she'll generally have to pay capital gains tax on the appreciation, and she'll have to pay tax on the depreciation that she took, recapture tax. Now, she passes under this scenario though. She bought it for $100,000. It's worth $200,000 when she passes away. Son inherits it. Let's say he sells it for $200,000. Son doesn't have to pay any tax. He literally gets $200,000 tax-free. So
okay.
the family, in essence, paid no tax on that appreciation. It's one of the relatively rare situations where a family can actually have an asset that's gone up in value, liquidate it, and not pay a penny in state or federal taxes.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that question and for that answer. Let's go to Brian in Madison. Hi, Brian. What's your question?
Hi, thank you. Maybe a related question. My mother is 86 years old, and she's at the point where we think she's going to have to leave her home and go either to assisted living or perhaps independent living. Initially, and my understanding is that when it gets, like if she eventually goes to a nursing home or any of us, the her primary residence is protected from that, from liquidation of assets to, you know, cover her expenses to be eligible for Medicaid. So I think if at this point, you know, it's not a nursing home situation, but is there anything that she could do at this point to protect the asset of her home, or, you know, is she likely going to have to sell it now to use the money for the next stage?
It's hate to give you a lawyer answer, but there are a lot of pieces to that puzzle. First off, I mean, one of the factors is the family situation. So is your father, or is your father alive, or does your mother have a spouse, living spouse?
My father is deceased.
Okay, sorry. So the house is not it's not a protected asset per se, just so you understand. So there is a possibility that if your mother didn't have other assets and she went on Medicaid or family care, another program in Wisconsin, that a lien can be put on the house. Okay, and the state of Wisconsin, through estate recovery rights, exercises its right against the house at your mother's passing. Are there ways to potentially protect the house? There are. I can't give specific, you know, legal advice here because there are quite a significant number of details. But it absolutely makes sense to have a consultation with an attorney that focuses in that area, someone in your geographic area, and there's plenty of, like I said, contact the state bar, and there's other organizations that you can do a search for someone in your area that handles that. But there are opportunities typically to protect at least a portion of the equity in the house. There may or may not be a portion to protect all of it, but it's highly likely there's a opportunity to protect a portion of it. You know, there's other I always tell families there's other factors to look at, understand, including where is mom going to get care, and how are you going to pay for that care? Because protecting assets is one thing, but, you know, getting your mother in this case, you know, appropriate care that you're comfortable with is also another factor. So, of course, assets have to be considered for that. And then you have to consider, you know, where she's going to go. Is it a place that has a continuum of care? In other words, if she has a situation where her care needs progress and get stronger, is she able to age in place within that particular facility, or would she have to completely move, which is often somewhat traumatic, especially for seniors, especially if there's some level of dementia involved. So choosing the right place is one factor, and the figuring out how to pay for it, of course, needs to be done at the same time. And we generally tell families, you know, we can sit here as attorneys and tell you the absolute right thing to do to protect the absolute, you know, maximum amount of assets. But if you can't get the care you want for a loved one, is that where you really want to go? How about we dovetail the legal plan into the care plan so that holistically it works?
Okay, thank you, Brian. Lots of things to look at there for sure. We're talking about health and financial planning with Ryan Zenk. He's a certified financial planner and the managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. If you have a question for him, give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. Ryan, we did get an email from Glenda. She wanted to recommend that if you have agreed to serve as power of attorney for someone, to make sure that person also agrees that you can make medical decisions for them. Do you agree with that?
That is an excellent point. Yeah, Glenda is spot on in that. You have to choose your agents carefully, and if you name someone who doesn't have the emotional wherewithal or just simply isn't interested in making those decisions, you know, that's not going to work out well. You can't force someone to be an agent. So Glenda is absolutely correct. That's very important to have a conversation with someone, especially when it comes to medical. This is obviously true on the financial side as well, but on a medical, understand that that's a significant emotional decision for folks. If they're, making a decision on terminating life support, for example, understand how difficult that can be for folks. And it's very important to have a conversation with that individual and make sure that they have you have a buy-in from them. And if they don't, then you need to find someone else, because that's not an appropriate agent mm-hmm. to nominate.
Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility for sure. Do you recommend that a family member be given that authority, or maybe someone that's a little more neutral?
The truth is, most people do name family members. I understand that. But there isn't. There's no one size fits all, so it's one of those it depends things. but my main advice is, and Glenda, she brought this up basically, is have a conversation with the individual you're naming before you put them on paper. They should be signing the medical power of attorney, so obviously they should know that they're nominated. But make sure you have a conversation about what your desires are, and not just simply name them and that's it, and not have a conversation about, what you would like to have done if you're in a, if you're in a coma or a state where you're not going to likely to recover. Mm-hmm. What would you want them to do? And have that conversation with them. That's very important.
Definitely. Let's go to Lee in Wisconsin Dells. Go ahead, Lee.
Good morning. I live in Wisconsin temporarily. I own little bits of property in three different states, not including Wisconsin. I'm probably going to move back to the South this next year. And I want to know if I make out a will here in Wisconsin, is that going to be valid for the property in other states, or how do I do this?
A will, so the question is, should you use a will for property located in, I think you said three other states, but not property located in Wisconsin. If you have a will, and assets pass through a will in most states, and definitely in Wisconsin, you're going to have a probate in that state to administer that will. So many states have something similar to Wisconsin. As I mentioned earlier, a transfer on death deed, and in Arizona they call it a beneficiary deed. Not all states allow you to name a beneficiary on real estate. So you'd have to check with the particular states where you have your property, but that may be an option. Another option for folks, so certainly we have a lot of clients that have real estate in multiple states, and they set up a living trust. And that living trust can own property in multiple states, and when they pass away, if it's done properly, there's not a probate, there's not a court proceeding required in those various states. With a will, there most likely will be a court proceeding required in all three different states in your case. So you literally have three probates going on for your estate, which can be very expensive.
Okay, thank you for the question, Lee. Good luck. Gary in Iron River, you're next. Go right ahead.
Thanks. Good morning. I have a question about I-bonds and a couple things. One, do they have a step up in value on transfer for the interest that is accumulated, but no annual running tax has been paid on them. So that's the first one, and then I got a little expansion on it.
Okay, so you own the I-bonds?
No, my mother owned the I-bonds. I had her financial power of attorney. I set up a Treasury Direct account. She died recently. Unfortunately, when she died, that account was locked, and
okay.
I could do nothing. And the Treasury Direct told me I had to set up a new account in the name of the estate, and I've processed that paperwork. The surprising or unfortunate part there is they tell me for any Treasury Direct stuff that requires paperwork, they're backed up 6 to 12 months. And
yes.
it'll be 6 to 12 months before they can cause this transfer, and I'll have any availability of those bonds. And the frustrating part is that was a small part of her estate that's probatable, and it was meant to provide some monies and income to deal with things as one went through the estate process.
Sure. Well, bonds in general, and I-bonds included, unfortunately, you don't get a step up in basis. It's interest. Bonds receive interest. It's not appreciation. So step up in basis is generally for things that that appreciate in value, whereas on bonds such as I-bonds, it's actually interest that has accumulated, and you do have to pay tax on that interest, just like you would on a CD or an annuity. So, unfortunately, there is a tax on that. Just for folks out there that do have bonds, there are ways to set bonds up to make it easier to pass to beneficiaries. A TOD designation often can be set on bonds. That stands for transfer on death. Typically, it's free to do that, and the asset will pass to the named beneficiary. Just like naming a beneficiary on a life insurance policy or retirement account.
Gary, what was your follow-up question on that?
Well, then for the taxes that are due, is there an option? I mean, like on her end-of-life tax account, could the accumulated interest be up from purchase to her time of death be claimed, or will it be the estate's? Or will it on the estate tax return, or will it be the tax return of the people who get the money?
Sorry to give you a lawyer answer. It depends. So that you're going to have to get specific advice from an attorney, and you're going to have to really the person's going to have to look at the totality of your mother's estate. Sometimes there are opportunities to pass tax consequences of the estate to beneficiaries and have them recognize it. Sometimes the estate recognizes it, and sometimes there's options to make choices on that. So there's not – I can't give you a simple answer on that. One would have to see – really look at the entire estate to make a determination about what the options are and what's in your best interest.
Okay, Gary, time to get some professionals helping you out there. Let's go next to Susan in Rhinelander. Hi, Susan.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I just had a follow-up question regarding the transfer on death deed, hopefully a quick question. In my scenario, I purchased a home as a single person in 2014 and then married in 2020. So it is my wishes that my husband would be able to effortlessly have the proceeds from the home, do whatever he wants with it. Would you still recommend a transfer on death deed be completed for spouses in that case where it's just me on the deed right now?
It depends. So you have there are several different options. What one can do if they have a spouse is they can name their spouse on the deed. So do a deed where there is a joint ownership between husband and wife as survivorship marital property, for example, and yet still have a TOD in place for contingent beneficiary or beneficiaries. So you've covered that possibility. There's always a possibility that one spouse, you know, the spouse who, in this case, that maybe you survive your husband, and then where do you want it to go? So a TOD would address that, even if you had joint ownership with a spouse. So you may look at, you know, potentially a combination of a couple things. One is adding spouse as a joint owner, if that makes sense, given other factors, and then having a TOD in place for ultimate beneficiaries when you're both gone.
Okay, and TOD stands for?
Transfer on death.
Okay, thank you very much. There's so many acronyms these days.
There is. I like other states call it beneficiary deed. I think that sounds nicer.
It does, doesn't it? TOD sounds like something you do in football. So anyway.
Yeah, correct.
We're talking health and financial planning with Ryan Zenk, a certified financial planner and the managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. And this is Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about the Wisconsin Special Olympics with an athlete and the president of the organization. And then we'll hear from the head coach of the UW Whitewaters men's wheelchair team as it prepares to compete in the 2024 Summer Paralympic Games in Paris. All that's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show starting at 11. Right now, we are talking about elder law and financial planning. And just a follow-up, Ryan, from what you were talking about with the caller earlier, and I don't mean to, you know, jinx it or anything, but what happens in that case when the Susan, I believe it was, if she puts it in her husband's name as well as hers and they split up, what happens then? Is it considered marital property and split evenly?
It very well could be. So that's a factor. So you have to look at, a number of different things. The other thing that could be problematic is what happens if she leaves it, if she adds her husband on there, she leaves it to her husband directly like that, and then, you know, he leaves it to other beneficiaries that she's not interested in. So, you know, she has a lot of different options. That's why it's impossible to give specific advice without asking a lot more questions.
Sure.
There's other options she has in terms of leaving it to a trust for the benefit of her husband for his lifetime. And then when he passes away, passing it down to other beneficiaries. She didn't mention that she was interested in other beneficiaries. So I don't know what her situation is,
sure. But
there's a lot. Again, you really have to get into the details. It's impossible to give an answer that's going to be appropriate without having more information. But yes, that definitely could be a problem if you add a spouse on there and you're concerned if there's a divorce with them, you know, walking away with half of it, absolutely.
Okay.
That's a potential issue.
Yeah, little experience with that. So anyway, Sherry in La Crosse, why don't you go ahead with your question?
Hi. I don't know if you covered this at the beginning, but is there a way to find out if their lawyer is more knowledgeable about estate planning for the, you know, elderly people with their finances and stuff? I'm asking because, you know, I used to work in a nursing home, and many times the family would say, well, the lawyer said we could put this money aside and still get Medicaid, and that's not exactly, and I'm broad strokes here, but not exactly how that works, but the lawyer said, and I think, you know, they were talking to the wrong people, perhaps. Is there a good...
I don't mean to laugh, but your experience is not unusual.
It's happened several times. In fact, my family.
Unfortunately, people get advice from not just lawyers, but all kinds of people that don't really understand. You shouldn't be giving advice, let's put it that way. So, that can be somewhat difficult, obviously, to assess the background But there are certain organizations that attorneys who specialize, for example, in elder law, are likely to belong to. And if someone does, an attorney does belong to it, it's highly likely that they specialize in that area. Like there's an organization called the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. And again, you know, I mentioned earlier the state bar. Most attorneys will tell the state bar what area they specialize in, and they may be a member of certain subcommittees, if you would, of the bar. In certain areas, so that may be one litmus test. The other thing I would recommend to people is just be very blunt and ask an attorney, do you specialize in this area? What's your experience in this area? And attorney's no different than a lot of other profession, whether it's doctors or you know, you don't call a plumber to do your electrical work, hopefully. So it does make sense to do that. And you're absolutely correct. We see all the time where someone may ask an attorney who maybe does estate planning, but doesn't focus on Medicaid planning, you know, how to protect assets, and or they ask their financial planner or someone else who may have some knowledge in the area, but doesn't deal with it day to day, and yeah, that certainly can be dangerous in terms of taking that advice.
Okay, thank you so much for bringing that up, Sherry. Appreciate that. Deb in Green Bay, you are next. Go right ahead.
Hello. I was wondering, my mom got a revocable trust where she put my sister and I on the house. She has since changed her mind and wanted me just to be on the house since I live with her and care for her. And the lawyer that we went to said I would have to get a quick deed of sale from my sister. And my sister is refusing to do that. My mom is really upset about this. I'm to the point where I don't really care one way or another. But is there anything that my mother can do via a lawyer or something like this to make changes? Because she's really upset about this.
Well, firstly, typically, your mother can make changes if she owns the house. But, you know, you said she created a revocable trust, and then you said that she put your sister and you on the house. Usually when someone has a revocable living trust, the house is in the trust. It's not owned by the beneficiaries. Well, they have a trust, and they're still alive. So,
names on it, including her husband.
I'm sorry, whose name is on it?
My mom's, my name, my sister's name, and the joint law, whatever it is in this state, my brother-in-law is on the house as well, on the deed of the house.
Okay, so your mother didn't put the house in a trust. She actually transferred an interest to yourself and your sister and your
brother-in-law is on it as well. Right.
Okay. Well, again, it depends. There are ways in the state of Wisconsin, not most states, but in Wisconsin anyway, that your mother could have kept the right to pull it back from any one of those. So I don't know if she retained the right to do that. If she did not, you definitely need to seek an attorney's counsel to see what her options are, because yeah, it may require that the individuals who have their name on it deed it over to other individuals if your mother literally gave up control of being able to do that. I do see that. I wouldn't encourage anyone to do that, but we do see it.
Okay, thank you, Deb. Beth in Kenosha, you're next. Go right ahead.
Hi, thank you. My mother is alive. We established a living trust for her roughly 14 years ago. Everything's been going well, but she's presently in hospice, and we'll be due to pass soon. Number one, I'm wondering, are there pitfalls that everybody falls into? Because I'm her successor trustee. I have two siblings. And I'm beginning to get a little bit worried as one of my siblings may want to have the house after she passes. And according to the trust and the will, you know, the house will be sold, and then the proceeds will be divvied up between the siblings, and that will be my job to do. So I'm just wondering if there are any ramifications of her actually physically being in the space prior to it being sold, and also, again, the pitfalls that I might fall into as I go through the process. Thank you.
Again, you know, there's the devil's in the details on your situation. But one thing I would encourage you to do at this time is just make sure that assets are properly funded. In other words, that assets are properly titled in the name of the trust or have beneficiaries on them. If not, if your mother's still able to execute documents legally, if she has capacity to do that, that's one bit of housekeeping that I would look at. As far as someone else challenging the terms of the trust, again, it depends on the trust. I mean, people can challenge pretty much anything, but whether or not they'd be successful is questionable. Hopefully, the trust has no contest clause in it, which doesn't eliminate someone contesting it, but can help mitigate any kind of success that they would have. And then you had a question about someone residing in it. So now you're getting into landlord-tenant law, or, you know, if they're going to squat in it, if they don't have a lease. I'm not sure what your situation is there. So that gets. You know, somewhat technical, but I wouldn't be overly concerned if someone someone does not have a legal right to reside in it and they're not in it now, with them challenging it, you know, they very well could, but the likelihood that they will be successful in challenging your mother's trust is not significant. It certainly isn't zero, but it's not significant as long as the property is in the trust and it was validly executed, and the person, you know, isn't a tenant in the property with a lease.
Okay. All right, Beth, thank you for that question. Brandon in Fitchburg, you have a question?
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have retirement accounts from previous jobs that I've worked. Is a lawyer going to be able to help me find those accounts? Because I'm having a hard time finding those accounts.
A lawyer may be able to. There are others out there that will do that as well. There are companies that actually make a living doing that. So you worked for the employer, and are the employers out of business, or how are you not able to contact the HR department and find out where their plans are?
One of them is out of business, as far as I know, yes. At least the business isn't where it used to be.
Okay. There are ways to track it down. I mean, the first thing I would do with the other ones is I would contact the human resource department for those particular places where you work. As far as the one that's out of business, you could look at contacting the Department of Labor as a website. And companies that manage a plan have to file an annual form 5500. And they have to report for every employee benefit plan that they manage, and that is public information. You also can look there's a website, Free ERISA, that you might want to check out to find on, you know, information on lost accounts.
Okay. Sorry about that, Ryan. We do have to break real quick here for the news. And if you had anything else you wanted to add to that, we can do that when we come back. This is a Larry Mueller Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. We've been talking about elder law and estate planning with Ryan Zenk, Managing Director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, based in Brookfield. He's an attorney and a certified financial planner. Ryan is also CEO of Family Wealth Advisors, LLC, and co-founder of Veterans Benefits, Inc. Do you have questions for Ryan? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. And Ryan, we have lots of emails, so let's do a few of those right now. Megan Madison emailed to say that her husband will be taking over the care of his disabled brother who lives in California, and he will need to be placed in a nursing home because unfortunately his brother's wife is terminally ill. And Meg wants to know what legal steps need to be taken for her husband to gain control of her brother's finances and placement at the time of her sister-in-law's death.
Well, wow, there's a lot there.
Yes.
So there's a whole number of factors. I don't know if he's talking about his brother, correct?
Correct. So Meg is the one that's emailing, and it's her husband's brother who lives in California, and he's disabled. So it sounds like he's being taken care of by his wife, but she is terminally ill.
Gotcha. So I'm not licensed in California, and it depends on if he's planning on having his brother move here or not. But I mean, there's a potential guardianship there. There may be some other options depending on his ability to, his capacity to sign documents to give him authority to handle things such as, powers of attorney, for example. But I would recommend he have a discussion if he's talking about Wisconsin. I would have a conversation with an attorney that handles guardianships and ask what the options are, and clearly ask what the options are in addition to guardianship, because sometimes it's easier and less expensive to bypass the court system as far as guardianship is concerned, but sometimes it does make sense to go through that. So if it's California, then he's going to have to deal with counsel in California.
Okay. Linda in Menominee emailed to ask about possible solutions for someone who has a spouse who has dementia and who needs to plan for her future care. How could assets be protected for her care? What options might be available?
It's when you deal with asset protection planning in a situation like that, I tell people it's a puzzle, and there's a lot of different pieces to it, and everyone's fact situation is very, very different, people's goals and options are different, and it depends on a whole bunch of different factors, quite frankly. So, the bottom line is have a conversation with someone who's competent in that area. You should be, whoever you deal with, you want to talk to them about your husband's current prognosis and what the expected care needs are in terms of progression. If there's a care plan in place, that should be brought to the attention of whoever you're dealing with. You should have specific information regarding your assets and income and expenses so that a plan can be put in place. The good news is that almost certainly there are significant things that she can do to protect assets so that a couple different things don't happen. Number one, that she doesn't have to spend down assets significantly to where she's unable to meet her lifestyle expenses. Secondly, obviously you want to make sure that the care plan for her husband is sustainable. In other words, that you can pay for it and that he can get the kind of care you want. And then lastly, There may be a consideration where you want to protect assets from the state of Wisconsin estate recovery. Understand that if someone has a spouse that at some point goes on family care or Medicaid, and they pass away, and then the non-disabled spouse later passes away, the state of Wisconsin typically does have recovery rights against the estate. There are legal options to protect assets if that's a goal, but you'd have to do something to do that. It's certainly not automatic. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of different things she could consider, and the good news is she definitely can, almost certainly can protect assets if she takes some action.
Okay, great. Thank you. Nancy in Monroe has a question. Go right ahead, Nancy.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband and I, we're in our late 60s, and we are working with a lawyer to update our will, and we were thinking about putting our house into an irrevocable trust. Looking at the paperwork now, we're getting a little bit nervous about doing that. I guess our main question is, if we sell our present house when it's in a trust, irrevocable trust, can we purchase another house with the money from the sale? Because it's really not in our name anymore. It's in the trust. And our son is the trustee.
Again, the lawyer answer, it depends. So can an irrevocable trust be set up so that the trustee of the trust can sell the property in it and then go buy another house? Certainly, they can be set up that way. There's a number of things which have to be taken into consideration. You have to look at the tax consequences. You have to look at how the irrevocable trust was set up so that on sale of principal residence, is there a capital gains that's going to be incurred that could have been otherwise avoided if it was in your name? Is the trust set up to be what attorneys call defective for income tax purposes so that it qualifies for capital gains exclusion on sale of principal residence? So there's a number of factors, tax factors that come in there. There's also an issue. Understand that if you transfer the house to an irrevocable trust, you're probably creating a potential penalty period, and it's subject to the look back for Medicaid purposes. That may not be an issue because you're relatively young, but that's something to understand. Also, you know, how much control do you lose? And you have to look at the purpose of why are you putting it in an irrevocable trust? What's the purpose of putting it in an irrevocable trust? And what are your other options? Because there are other ways to transfer a residence to make sure that it bypasses probate when you're both gone, to make sure that it is protected if either of you has a long-term care event, without the cost and some of the potential issues if it's in the irrevocable trust. So I think you need, you know, and maybe you've already done that with the attorney, but there's a whole bunch of things to consider when you put something in an irrevocable trust: tax consequences, loss of control, and other factors.
Okay, thank you, Nancy. So many options, aren't there?
Definitely.
Yeah. Now, we've been kind of getting in the weeds here, so let's kind of go back to some basics.
Sure.
What are the requirements of a will to be legal in Wisconsin?
Sure. So in Wisconsin, it is important that well, there's a number of factors. First of all, the person that signs it has to have capacity to do so. And it does require two witnesses. We do recommend that they also have it notarized. It becomes more difficult. It's not required, but it makes it more difficult to challenge. It becomes self-proving, is a lawyer word. So it does require two witnesses, 18 or older, unrelated by blood or marriage, to witness it. But it can be a relatively simple document. It does have to be written. Wisconsin does not recognize oral wills. We do tell people, don't make the mistake of thinking you can change your will simply by crossing off a name and putting someone else's name, writing someone else's name above it, maybe initialing by that, you may have just made the entire will invalid by doing that.
Sure.
So there are requirements on amending them as well. Attorneys call it a codicil. You know, we go to law school for a long time to make simple things more difficult, so we add in these fancy words. Makes us seem smarter. Sometimes we throw a little Latin in there, you know, per stirpes or something, just to, you know, then we seem even smarter.
That's right.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Very, very, yes, we understand that very much. When you're doing your will, and actually we had an email from Susie. He was wondering, where can she get that? I think you mentioned it earlier, but let's talk about that again. Where can you get a form, or, you know, what can she do if she really can't afford to have an attorney draw it up? Or maybe it's, you know, she has a simple estate.
Sure. I understand that, and you know, I get that. It is an area, though, and again, I'm not trying to be self-serving because I don't care who you work with. There are pro bono clinics out there, okay, to help people that don't charge. Certainly there are forms on the Internet. The problem with grabbing a form off the Internet is if it doesn't work, it's usually too late to change it. So that might not be the best idea. Often you can find an attorney that'll do a will for a few hundred dollars. The cost of, you know, a really good dinner out for a couple or something. So it usually isn't terribly expensive. But there are places you could get it for free. There's pro bono clinics, and you can contact the state bar. But depending on where one lives in the state of Wisconsin, in the metro area, certainly Madison, Milwaukee, there's clinics where one can get some of those documents for free if it's very simple. But it is an area where I understand cost is a factor, but it shouldn't be necessarily the overriding, because it isn't terribly expensive. Mm-hmm. And understand that there's a lot of other options other than just a will, like I said earlier, like naming beneficiaries on assets, which if someone has a very simple estate, they can probably do that. Any beneficiary, any asset with a beneficiary named on it, done properly, isn't going to go through a will anyway. It's going to go to the intended beneficiary very relatively simply when you pass away, and often it's free to do that.
Yeah, just as an example, when my father passed away, my sister and I were both on his property deeds. Mm-hmm. And so we had to do was show the death certificate, and it was transferred over to us. Very simple.
Very simple, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, very easy. Wisconsin is pretty friendly. Like, I know not all states have that. Like, to the best of my knowledge, Florida doesn't allow beneficiary deeds, but Wisconsin does, people can do some really, really simple things that can work, and often they're free or close to free.
Right. And we were in Michigan, so it was, you know, that state.
Yes.
Also.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So when should people revisit or revise their legal wills, or maybe even the advanced directives that we talked about earlier?
That's a good question, Jill. Obviously, if they have a change of mind in terms of who they want to have in charge in that. But I do tell people that every few years, I think it's a good idea, as I maybe said earlier, to kind of, you know, dust off your estate plan and just take a look at it. Make sure you have the right person or people named in terms of who's going to be in charge. If that's a situation, if you have a will or a trust, for example, or powers of attorney. So there isn't a set timeline, but certainly if there's a change in life events, you should revisit it. If there's a death or a pending disability, or again, if there's a change in the situation with the people you've named and they fall out of favor, or you think someone else is more appropriate.
What kind of assets or instructions should be listed in a will?
that's a real open question. So, it depends. So sometimes a will isn't the best tool. So you really don't want to necessarily say anything. So someone, you can have a will that you know doesn't name any specific assets. If someone just has a general bequest, they just want to leave everything to, you know, these two people or three or whatever the situation is. So they don't actually name specific assets to go to any particular beneficiary or whatever. But often it is less expensive for the beneficiaries to receive their assets without them having to go through the probate process. And so we haven't talked about this, but maybe this is a good time just to kind of mention, if someone passes away with a will and their assets pass through the will, okay, they do have to go through this court proceeding called probate. And probate, what's the disadvantage of probate? It takes a little time and it costs some money. So it takes typically 10 to 13 months in the state of Wisconsin, depending on the county you're in. And it costs some money. The court charges a fee. The attorneys, of course, have to charge a fee. And so, you know, you're paying somewhere typically 3%, 4%, 5% of the gross value of the estate, usually in cost, and it takes about a year. There are ways to avoid that, for your beneficiaries to avoid that, a trust or listing beneficiaries, and there's other methods as well. So I think what makes sense is for folks to get educated about what their options are, and then they can make an intelligent decision. I would counsel you to whenever you go to work with a professional, an estate planning attorney, for example, don't necessarily ask for what they recommend. Maybe ask them, what are my options? And certainly you can ask for their recommendation about which option they might choose, but they might have a different idea about what's most important, different than what you might think is most important. So I think it's a good idea to understand, get educated about what your options are. Then you can make an educated decision about what you think is best.
Yeah, that makes sense, because there are so many, as we've definitely given an example of today. Yeah. So what happens if a deceased person's estate cannot cover their outstanding debts?
Sure. So it depends on, again, in the law, it depends on what their estate plan was. But in general, this is an oversimplification. But in general, there's typically about a year after death that a creditor would have to come forward. Now, if there's a probate, it's typically 4 months from the date of publication. So it really depends on whether they had a trust or they have a will. Or they don't have any estate plan at all. They die what's called intestate, and a probate has to get open for that. You know, sometimes it can be a shorter period. Obviously, if the creditor is secured, you have a home that has a mortgage on it, for example. Well, that mortgage is going to stay on the property. The beneficiaries aren't liable for a decedent's death generally. Okay, a decedent's debts when they pass away. So let's say, for example, there was a situation that fortunately isn't too common, but did happen back in 08, 09 when we had real estate drop in value significantly, where someone passes away and maybe they owe more on a mortgage than the house is worth. The beneficiaries don't have to worry that they're liable for you know, paying the difference. That isn't the case. But that debt is still on that property in that case. But generally, and again, this is an oversimplification, but creditors have a year, and sometimes significantly less than that, to come forward, or their claims are wiped out.
Mm-hmm. And that should go to, well, let's say the survivors, if they're contacted by a creditor directly, what should they do?
Well, it depends. I mean, if it's for a $100
right, yeah, how much
bill, it might be worth just paying it, but they may wish to seek counsel if it's anything significant and just find out what their options are, because it does. There's a number of variables that come into play depending on the nature of the debt and the nature of the estate and, mm-hmm. and how the assets were passed to them, because there are different timelines.
Okay. In the last minute or so that we have before we have to say goodbye, do you have some words of advice for those who are wondering about their financial planning and wills and that type of thing?
Well, I just in general, I think it makes sense to have some plan in place, and it isn't terribly complicated. You can typically set up an appointment with an attorney that focuses in that area and sit down and spend 45 minutes having a conversation about what your options are, you know, given your goals and given the nature of your estate. And then you put something in place and you go on and you live your life. And, you know, I always tell people, I mean, you really don't do estate planning for yourself, right? You do
right.
it for those you love mm-hmm. and people that you care about. So it makes sense to do it, because there will be something that has to be done if you have any assets at all. And it's a good idea. And often it's pennies on the dollar you will spend to get something put in place that will take care of things when you pass away. You work hard your life, you save up some things, and do you want that going to creditors or attorneys or the court, or do you want it to go to, you know, a charity or people you care about?
That's right. The best thing you can leave is not having to have them worry about it when you're gone.
That's so, right.
Yeah.
That's right. Jill, that's a good point. And it gives you know, if nothing else, I say, you know, it'll give you a peace of mind. It's one of those,
sure.
you know, when you lay your head on the pillow at night and oh, I got to get that done. I got to
yes.
get that checked off the list.
Yeah, one less thing to worry about. Well, Ryan,
right.
thank you so much for being with us today. We really appreciate you taking all that time out of your day to share your advice with our listeners.
Great talking to you, Jill.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You bet. Ryan Zenk is the managing director of the Elder Law Center of Wisconsin, based in Brookfield. He is an attorney and a certified financial planner. Ryan is also managing director of Family Wealth Advisors, LLC, and co-founder of Veterans Benefits Incorporated. Now, up next, we're going to change things around a bit, and we're going to take a visit to a Wisconsin town that has a long connection with the Wizard of Oz. So stay with us. Well, next week, the city of Oconomowoc is definitely going to be off to see the Wizard. They're going to be celebrating the 85th anniversary of the release of The Wizard of Oz in movie theaters. Now, some sources say that the world premiere of the film was at the Strand Theater in Oconomowoc back in August of 1939, but there are other records that maybe it's not quite right. So we're going to question someone who knows. I'm Jill Nadeau. This is the Larry Mueller Show. And that person is Justin Agar Pratt. He's the director of the Oconomowoc Area Historical Society and Museum. And he's looking through the records, and he knows what the city has planned to celebrate its connection to the Land of Oz. What do you remember about the first time you saw the Wizard? Wizard of Oz. And who scared you more, the Wicked Witch of the West or the Flying Monkeys? We'd like to hear from you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Justin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Jill. It's great to be here.
You bet. So next week in Oconomowoc, big celebration because of the release of the film. So let's straighten us out about these first screenings here.
Well, as a historian, I find myself in positions like this a lot where you're really trying to dig and find out what actually happened. It's, you know, it's not like chemistry. We can't recreate it in a lab. So ever since I took on the job as director at the Historical Society in Oconomowoc back in March, my 90% of my time has been filled with Oz-related artifacts and memorabilia and artwork and events and the history and trying to dive in and learn the history. So it's interesting because the world preview premiere of the film was supposed to take place on August 9th in 1939 at the Carthay Circle Theater, which is where Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs had its premiere a few years ago. And that film actually kind of made MGM feel like they could make a big musical like The Wizard of Oz, a musical fantasy. But that preview premiere was pushed off, according to sources at the LA Times and Variety in August of that year. So there were actually a couple of screenings in Wisconsin, as well as Cape Cod, interestingly enough. Oconomowoc's at the Strand Theater started August 12th. Now there were showings in Green Bay, Kenosha, Appleton before that. But I will say that it was billed in Oconomowoc as the world premiere showing. And we've got a copy of that advertisement hanging in our museum in Oconomowoc. Now, I don't know if that was the Strand, if that was MGM or the newspaper, but it was a brilliant piece of marketing because, you know, even though there were other showings before Oconomowoc's, Oconomowoc can claim the world premiere showing.
I love that.
The connection between Oconomowoc and The Wizard of Oz is even stronger because the film's composer, the composer of the score, not the songwriter, Herbert Stothart, was actually born in Milwaukee, went to UW-Madison, spent a lot of time in Okochee. His mother built two cottages in Okochee. And so it's highly likely, you know, people ask, why Oconomowoc? Why did they choose Oconomowoc? We don't have any documentation from MGM that states because of this, but it's highly likely that's why.
Mm-hmm. And why did MGM want to go to the Heartland to have this preview premiere?
Well, they wanted to see kind of what Middle America, how they would react to this film. You know, the movie didn't have its Hollywood premiere until August 15th at Grauman's Chinese Theater. And then it opened in New York on August 17th for its East Coast premiere. And I believe Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney were actually on a circuit of the East Coast, you know, helping promote it. So they wanted to get the feel again of what the reviews would be and the sentiments of Middle America.
And I think I've read a lot about The Wizard of Oz too. We've had a couple of books on the show. What do you think it is about this movie that we just can't get out of our culture?
Well, I think we have to thank the television for that part. You know, it's a great film, and audiences, you know, reacted positively to it when it came out. It was by no means a flop. MGM didn't really start making money on it until much later. And part of what has ingrained that film into our culture, and I mean, you know, when for just about anyone, right? If you hear the name Dorothy, and for those of you out there named Dorothy who maybe don't want to be associated with the film, I'm sorry, but Dorothy, Toto, even Kansas, unless you're from Kansas, right? All these things. And it wasn't until, you know, the 1950s when, you know, CBS and NBC kind of traded off for a while, showing it every year on television. And I, you know, that's really kind of when it took off in being kind of ingrained in our culture and being this mammoth success. And then, of course, with the advent of home video and then DVD and re-releases and anniversaries. So, but I mean, all of that aside, the music's great. The story's fun. It's still, I saw it on a big screen last year. I took my mom to a Mother's Day brunch showing. And that was actually my first time seeing it on the big screen. And it is a gorgeous film. It really is.
And it's amazing because I happened to see it in actually in Watertown a few years ago. And I was like, what the heck? I missed this, all these background things that are going on. There's some live birds in the background during the apple orchard scene. And I thought I was seeing things at first. So it really does pay to see it on the big screen, doesn't it?
For sure.
Yeah. Now, there's another Wisconsin connection to The Wizard of Oz and really the Johnson Creek area, Watertown, the resident, Minard Robbie. He played the coroner. If we remember him, in fact, if you don't remember him, we've got a clip.
As coroner, I must have her. I thoroughly examined her, and she's not only merely dead, she's really most sincerely dead.
And I'm really sorry that's going to be stuck in your head all day. maybe not. And also, I was always wondered, as coroner, I must aver. That's the word, in case anyone was wondering what it was, because I had no clue. So anyway, tell us about Meinhard Robbie.
Yeah, well, he was from Farmington, and his family used... they lived in Johnson Creek, you know, spent a lot of time there, used Watertown as kind of their postal address. Meinhard Robbie went to school in Watertown for a time at what is now Luther Prep, but what was then known as Northwestern College. Went to UW-Madison, I believe. He was in the military. He was the first little Oscar, you know, driving around the country with the Wienermobile. And then, of course, played the Munchkin Coroner in The Wizard of Oz. And there's a great book that he wrote that came out not long before he passed away that is all about his life. I played the Munchkin Coroner as a freshman in high school. And through some, I don't know how these connections were made, I got to meet his sister, who was still living in Watertown at the time. And she was just got to talk to her about their life growing up, about Meinhard. He was still alive at the time. And a few weeks after I met her, I got some packages in the mail, and it was his book signed by Meinhard. There was a Wizard of Oz promotional poster signed by him as well. So, I got a personal connection to the film through that. I never actually got to meet him, but I got about as close as you could get.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And actually, Meinhard didn't pass away all that long ago, 2010. I believe he was the last, surviving cast member with dialogue.
I think you're right. Yeah.
He was 94. So that's pretty cool. We definitely want to hear about what's going to be going on in Oconomowoc, but, we're going to take a little break here. We're talking, about the beloved movie, The Wizard of Oz, with Justin Agar Pratt. He's the director of the Oconomowoc Area Historical Society and Museum. What do you love about the film? We'd really like you to take part in this conversation. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. Tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, we'll join in on Olympic fever, but in a slightly different way. First, we're talking about Special Olympics Wisconsin and how they're making sports more inclusive. And then we hear from a wheelchair basketball head coach who's headed to the Olympics. Finally, we'll have a roundup of success stories from the 2024 Olympic Games so far. So that's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show, starting at 11. And right now, we are talking about the Wizard of Oz and this great celebration that's going to be happening in Oconomowoc. What's the date on that, Justin?
So that's Thursday, August 15th. So coming right up.
Mm-hmm. And Oconomowoc, for those who are not familiar, is basically, what, west of Milwaukee, about 30 minutes, approximately?
A little bit.
Yeah. So, okay. So what do you guys have planned?
Oh, well, there's a lot. Well, so back in 2019, Oconomowoc opened up the Oz Plaza. So if you've been through Oconomowoc since then, you've probably seen they've got statues of characters from The Wizard of Oz. You know, Oconomowoc, they're very invested in this historic connection that they've got with Wizard of Oz. And the statues have been, I guess you could say they had some time at the spa over the last year or so, and they've been refurbished and refreshed. And we at the museum have been fortunate enough to actually have each of those statues, except for the wizard, pass through our museum before they, you know, they've been kind of slowly rolling out at Oz Plaza. And we still have at our museum, and I think maybe she's leaving tomorrow, Dorothy and Toto. But we've got two new statues that were not at the original Oz Plaza. We've got Glinda and Meinhart Robbie's Coroner.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those two are going to be unveiled the night of the event on Thursday, August 15th, but they're at the museum. And so you can see them. You know, these statues are made to be outside in all of the elements, but you can see them inside in the air conditioning during our normal hours. So, you know, there's the Oz Plaza kind of revamp that's going to have its completion on August 15th.
Mm-hmm.
And then the activities for the event start at 4 o'clock that afternoon. Now, Wisconsin Avenue, which is kind of the main drag there, will open for chair setup at 1 o'clock. And people might be wondering, what do I need chairs for? Is there going to be a parade? Well, the big feature of the event is at dusk, they're going to show The Wizard of Oz on a huge screen projecting down Wisconsin Avenue. And it's part of their Moonlit Movies program, which, if you haven't been to that event, is really fabulous. But between the time the activities begin and the feature presentation, they're going to have that Oz Plaza ribbon cutting. There's a costume contest. There's all sorts of activities. They've got hot air balloon rides. There's going to be some live music, characters, food vendors, all sorts of things. So it's going to be a really wonderful event. And these anniversary screenings are great. You know, they do them every 5 years. So it definitely doesn't wear out its welcome. I think there's, you know, there's definitely an appetite for it whenever it comes around. And it's going to be a great time.
Definitely. Yeah, they do it every 5 years. And you're right. It just makes it more special. We've got a couple callers. So let's talk to Pat in Sturgeon Bay. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi. I called because I wanted to share a memory of seeing The Wizard of Oz on television. I was born in 1952, so it fits right in what the speaker has been saying about when they put it on television. And it was such a big deal. This was, of course, way before cable. And we all got, you know, made popcorn and got ready to watch The Wizard of Oz on television, and it was in black and white at that time. We didn't have color TV quite for another 10 years. But anyway, I remember I was about 5 years old or so, and we were watching this movie, and when that witch came on, I was totally traumatized. And I was sitting by my mother, and I hid my face in her lap and would not look at that witch. And I... so frightening, but she let me finish watching the movie because I guess they weren't into trauma back in those days. So So I watched the movie, and then we watched it for years. I think it came out on, I want to say it was either like Thanksgiving or Easter time. Every year it would come on, and I got over the trauma eventually, although it has stuck with me all these years because I just so remember being so frightened. But I've loved The Wizard of Oz, and I've loved the follow-up later, the Wicked play. It's the only Broadway type musical I've seen twice, because I love that part so much too. So lots of good if traumatic memories of Wizard of Oz on TV.
Well, I think you managed to put that behind you a little bit, Pat. So thanks for sharing that with us. I remember too, the first time I saw The Wizard of Oz, the first few times we only had black and white TV. So the whole, you know, coming to Oz and all the beautiful color, I think that just shocked me when I saw it the first time in actual color, because it made such a difference. So it's a kind of a great concept too. I think it was one of the first movies that ever did that, went from black and white, which is actually more of a sepia, and then to the color. Pretty neat effect. Greg and Racine, what do you have for us?
Hi there. First, I want to say hi to Justin from one of your old props at Carthage.
Oh, hey there.
Which is me. Nice to hear you. I'm enjoying this conversation very much, although I didn't hear the very beginning of it. But sounds like a wonderful celebration about one of the greatest films ever made. This film means a lot to my family because I was the Tin Man when I was in grade school, and my brother, a few years later, was the Scarecrow in a very different production someplace else. But always loved this film so much. And early to Robbie, the coroner, one of my jobs outside of teaching at Carthage, where I taught Justin many years ago, is at a radio station that's on this network. And I got to interview Mr. Robbie about his book, which I think is called Memories of a Munchkin, if I'm not mistaken. That's off the top of my head. And
that's correct.
One of the things I remember about that conversation is he was a fairly elderly man by that point and a little bit hard of hearing. And right off the bat, as the first couple of questions and the answers were a little halting, I thought, oh, I wonder how this is going to go. And before long, he'd kind of caught his second wind, and he was telling story after story. And of course, he's had a very interesting life, even apart from the film. So for people who are curious to know more about him, I'm sure that book, one way or another, is still available, and I really highly recommend it.
Well, thank you, Greg. Appreciate that comment. And just so you guys know, it wasn't that long ago that Justin was in college.
Right.
He made you sound pretty old there. And he's not. So let's get back to some of the stuff that's going on. Now, you're talking about the Oz Plaza. Now, I had read somewhere that you not only are adding to the statues that you have there, but you're doing some other stuff, too. Can you tell us what's going on there? Or are you sworn to secrecy?
Well, I think if I know what you're talking about, there are going to be a number of Toto statues popping up around the city. Is that what you're referring to?
I don't know, because we haven't. I don't know. It sounded all secret when I read it, so I'm not sure.
Well, as far as I know, this is public knowledge. I just saw it in the Enterprise the other day. So
okay. Yeah.
There are a number of Toto statues that are going to be popping up all throughout the city, kind of like the Badgers in Madison,
sure,
where, you know, they're all painted with different themes to invoke either the business or the organization or something like that has them. And the museum is going to have a Toto as well. And we're still working on getting the artwork finalized. But, those Toto statues are going to be popping up all over Oconomowoc. So it's going to be really fun. I don't know how many there are, about a dozen or so,
great,
I think.
Yeah, that'll be fun for sure. Mm-hmm. And let's talk about the museum. Where is it located in Watertown, or in Oconomowoc? And what kind of exhibits do you have going on?
Yeah, so we're located at 103 West Jefferson Street. If anyone knows Roosevelt Park, we're on the corner. Our museum is in the 1921 National Guard Armory Building. The National Guard is no longer there. They moved out in the mid-80s. But it's a great Spanish colonial style building. If you've been past it, but you didn't know it was a museum, you're not alone. But think of the building with the elk in front of it, the elk statue, which used to stand on one of the vast estates on one of the lakes in the Conemaugh. You know, we have kind of our highlight exhibits. I mean, right now we've got Oz for the next few weeks. So if you want to see Oz memorabilia, stop in. Our two main exhibits are the Streets of Old Conemaugh, much like the Streets of Old Milwaukee, only focused on Conemaugh. And then we've got a really large HO gauge model railroad layout that was started by a former custodian of the Conemaugh High School who has since passed away. He left his layout to us. The thing that I love, though, is it's not just a really spectacular and detailed layout. There's a group that a dedicated group. In fact, they're probably there right now. They go in on Mondays when we're closed and maintain it and clean it. And they run this thing. They have operating days where they, you know, you kind of pretend it's a real railroad and they have schedules and all of that. And there's a youth group that's attached to it too, that comes in monthly. So you've got kids actually learning about the hobby. And so it's an active learning center, which I love. And, you know, we're kind of on the cusp right now as an organization of making some changes and revamps. But I can tell you the Streets of Old Conemaugh are not going anywhere. I love that. It's a great area. So the museum is open Tuesday through Thursday from 1 to 4 and then Sundays from 1 to 4 as well. So definitely stop in and see what we've got.
So what is Oconomowoc's claim to fame? I mean, is the lake?
There's a lot of things. You know, there's the lakes, obviously, the Wizard of Oz. A lot of, you know, I've been learning about Oconomowoc history myself since I started in March. You know, they hired me for my museum expertise, not necessarily. I didn't have to take a test on Oconomowoc history.
You didn't?
Yeah. But, you know, I've been learning a lot from our volunteers who have been there for a long time. A lot of companies that I didn't know, you know, made their way through there. Carnation was a big one. Obviously, you know, Brownberry Ovens is a big company. It's a great city with lots of history that, again, I'm still learning about.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, names of families that people might recognize, or maybe they don't recognize the family name, but they recognize the industries or the businesses they were involved in, you know, had homes around the lakes and helped make Conemaugh what it is.
And wasn't there a train that came out from Milwaukee and a lot of summer people that built really beautiful homes in Oconomowoc?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, when you learn the history of a lot of those historic mansions, you find out a lot of them, you know, lived elsewhere, a lot of them in Chicago, some St. Louis. And yeah, they'd come up for the summers and, you know, enjoy their time there. And of course, we've got the old train depot, which is not a train depot anymore, but is a great restaurant down there as well. And that depot, as well as other actual buildings, are represented on that model railroad layout that I mentioned. And that's the Milwaukee Road. So they've got all stops all along there represented on the layout.
Well, that's fun. Now we've got a few minutes left, but it's really difficult for small museums these days to stay alive. Is that something that they've found? I mean, I know you've only been there since March, but is that true in the case of the Oconomowoc Museum also?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, we've got a fairly healthy endowment, but we need to feed that, as all small nonprofits do. And so we're just, you know, we're looking at ways of first letting people know that we're here. And that's not unique to Oconomowoc. That's, you know, any small museum I've spent time in, whether employed or, you know, interned, you know, people always say, we had no idea you were here.
Yeah.
So just letting people know we're there. Membership support is crucial, and I'm working on increasing the member value. And then fundraising. We've got a big fundraiser gala coming up Thursday, September 26th. It's called the Supper Club Experience. It's going to be at Wisconsin's oldest restaurant, the Red Circle Inn. It's going to be a great time. And we've got an author named Ron Fiola, who a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with, Supper Club guru, and he'll be there. So, again, our biggest fundraiser of the year, Thursday, September 26th. You can check out our website and Facebook page for all the information.
Wonderful. So. Well, thank you very much, Justin. We really appreciate you stopping by, and have fun at the Wizard of Oz on August 15th?
15th. Yep, Thursday, okay. August 15th.
Wonderful.
Festivities start at 4.
Okay. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us today on The Larry Mueller Show. This and all our other shows, of course, are a team effort. So we're running out of time, but thank you all for our help. I'm Jill Nadeau in for Larry Mueller today.